You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. New from Moultrie Mobile, the Feed Hub offers first-of-its-kind cellular connection and control for nearly any spin cast feeder on the market. When used with the Moultrie Mobile app, you can monitor feed and battery levels, run feeders on demand, receive alerts when feeders are clogged, and remotely adjust feeding times. The Feed Hub is ideal for anyone who maintains feeders. Remove the guesswork and save time by planning feeder maintenance before you drive to your hunting property. For more information, visit MoultrieMobile.com. Mic check. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Nine Finger Chronicles. And today we got a unique episode. And the guest is Skip Sly. He is a fellow Iowan. And the goal was to talk about deer behavior throughout different types of the year. And we touched base on it a little bit, but Skip has a way of getting excited when we start talking about any type of whitetail stuff, whether that's strategy, whether it's habitat work, food plots, hinge cutting, all that stuff that he gets excited about as well, because he's a habitat guy. Dude loves habitat. And so I thought he would be a good, it'd be a good idea to bring him into the podcast and talk a little bit about deer behavior that he has seen over the years. And although we did talk about it, it's best to just let Skip go. Okay, when he starts getting excited and when he starts getting on a roll, it's hard to bring him back, right? And we just let him go. And then when he's done, we ask him a different question, and then he goes. And then we ask him another question, and then he goes. And so you're just along for the ride at that point, and that's what today's episode is. We're just along for the ride. You know, this is Skip's world. We just live in it. And like I said, we talk a little bit about deer behavior, but then we get into habitat. We get into what kind of neighbors are good neighbors for hunting, you know. I don't even really want to explain it other than we're getting into a lot of good conversation today. And it's basically just Skip schooling us all. So before I get into today's episode, though, we do have to do a couple commercials. And first off, before commercials, we got something even more important. And that is, if you are starting to find morel mushrooms, all you have to do is send me a pic just a message. Say, hey, we're getting into them. You know, we found them. I don't want to know where. All I want to know is if it's worth my time to go out and start looking for them yet. Some grays have popped up in Iowa here. No yellows, but you know, the rain is gonna help, but there's a temperature drop now. So I think we're gonna have to wait a handful more days just to get the warmer temperatures back up and get these mushrooms to pop so I can start looking for them. Okay, morel mushrooms are obviously what's on my mind right now. Outside of that, we gotta do a commercial break now. And if you are looking for saddles, saddle hunting accessories, they even have a new turkey vest that I just got in after my turkey season was over. I still might have some time to go out there and go hunting myself, but it's a high quality turkey vest. Go check it out, tetherednation.com, wasparchery.com. in my opinion, some of the best broadheads on the market, both fixed and mechanical, as well as a majority, not all, but a majority of their heads are made in America. Discount code NFC20 for 20% off of all WASP products. Vortex Optics, spotting scopes, rangefinders, sunglasses, apparel, rifle scopes, spotting scopes, you name it when it comes to optics, red dots, you name it, they have it. And especially red dot season here for during turkey season. So go check that out. You can go to Euro Optic, EUROOPTIC voicemail.com and you can save 10% off of all Vortex orders by simply just entering the discount code, the number 9, followed by the word finger, followed by the number 10. So 9 finger 10, and that's going to get you 10% off at Euro Optics and Vortex. Feed hub, if you're looking for a way to control your spin cast feeder from hundreds of miles away, that's going to let you know when you need to refill. You can schedule feeding times. You can remotely unclog clogs. There's a whole bunch of different things that you can do. So go to MoultrieMobile.com and check out the feed hub at MoultrieMobile.com. It connects to the Moultrie Mobile app, and you can use it on the same platform that you run your Moultrie Mobile cell cams. Next on the list is Code Blue. I'm going to be putting in an order here within the next week or so for mock scrapes, so that mock scrape kits, the rope-a-dope system, so that when it's time to get out in the woods, start putting out mineral, trimming trees, things like that, I'm going to also be setting up some Code Blue scent rope-a-dope systems, aka mock scrapes, and get deer as close as possible. Discount code NFC20 excuse me, for 20% off. CodeBlueScents.com. Woodman's Pal, if you're looking for a machete or a habitat tool that's going to help you hack out bushes, shooting lanes, any type of machete. This company's been around since 1941. They are made in, they're all of their products are made in America. They also have a very high quality list of leather goods as well. I believe they have a holster as well. So go check out woodmanspal.com. Next is Huntworth. If you are looking for, in my opinion, some of the highest quality camo on the market, then you definitely need to go check out huntworthgear.com and check out all of their products, from warm to their base layers to their mid-season to their cold with the heat boost technology. Definitely go check out Huntworth. In my opinion, you're getting a ton more for your dollar when you go with Huntworth. High quality stuff too. So huntworthgear.com. Last but not least, I just released a new Full Sneak Fight Club t-shirt, and I'm not gonna lie, it's badass, man. The logo on it is badass. $2 fighting. So go check out fullsneakgear.com. Take advantage of a current discount that I have running, 10% off, FSG10, and that's gonna save you 10% off your order at fullsneakgear.com. So there's that. I did all my prostituting, got it all out of the way, paid my bills. Now it's time to listen to a guy who loves whitetails talk about whitetails. 3, 2, 1. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, brought to you by Tethered, Wasp, Vortex, Moultrie Mobile's Feed Hub, Code Blue Scents, The Woodman's Pal, Huntworth, and of course, Full Sneak Gear. Today we are joined by fellow Iowan, Mr. Skip Sly. Skip, how we doing, man?
Good. Rainy day, a lot of catch up. Got to adapt every day and just keep the projects moving forward, but we got rained out, so
yep.
I'm scrambling, and I'm at a different location today.
Different location. Yep. Never. You don't seem like the kind of guy who, even if you didn't do all this deer work, you're just not the type of guy who like just sits still ever.
I can't sit still.
Okay. Yeah.
That's so I went to college for engineering and different business stuff. And I got some internships before I graduated where I sat in cubicles or sat in an office. And maybe 3 months before I graduated college, I had offers to come work, and they're like, hey, you want to work? And I was blunt. I just said, there's no way I can sit in an office or a cubicle all day. I will do something totally different.
Yeah.
And what my degree was in, I threw that out the window.
Yeah.
Right before I graduated. And I scrambled at the last minute just asking people, hey, what can I do to make money where I don't have to sit at a desk? And yeah, that fits my personality. Have to be out and about, moving around, outside. I can't sit still.
Yeah, I feel you, man.
Unless it's in a deer stand.
Unless it's in a deer. Yeah, there you go. There you go.
Which is kind of bizarre, but yeah, then I'm the most patient. You know, I can sit there days and days and days and days, and I love it. But if you try and get me to do the same thing in a cubicle or an office, I'd lose my mind.
Oh, man. I lost it. There was a time there for a while I just, man, I dreaded, absolutely dreaded having to go into work that it was just like the most, I don't know what was worse, sitting in the cubicle or the car ride going into work knowing that I had to sit in a cubicle for 8 hours. It was depressing at times.
Yeah, I got a few people walking in. Let me go downstairs real quick.
Yeah, no worries.
Hold on. Can we edit that part out?
Yeah, I don't edit anything. I just let everything roll, man. It's all good.
They will be going downstairs, but not for like.
All right, we got time. So
doesn't your wife know that you have like this cult following and that you're like a podcast sensation?
No, she doesn't care. She thinks it's funny. And I mean, you know, she just knows. I mean, she just knows I'm obsessed with this stuff. I love it. The one thing that catches her attention probably is like I'm on the phone with different people, maybe helping them with projects or answering questions, and she just kind of rolls her eyes and said, "Oh, yeah, Skip's talking about deer hunting again or farms," and that's every day,
right?
So, absolutely. No, I mean, you know, when you love what you do and you're helping people out, and you love your job, you know, who can complain with that? And I do, and I know my wife. You know, she knows I love all this stuff and I'm passionate about it. And, you know, that's why even the job I was just talking about where I found the job I wanted to do where I was out and about, I eventually didn't like that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I quit that to do this, which I totally love. So I've got my dream job, and, you know, just at a stage in the, a stage in the journey where I can help other people. And, you know, it's kind of a bigger picture thing now.
Yeah.
Give back and, you know, even stuff like this, keep Iowa great. And
yep.
I mean, yeah, who could, it's just a great job. Great.
Absolutely.
I love every day. I have headaches, but I love every day.
Right.
Yeah. It's chaotic today.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So, let's get into the topic today, and that is, I want to talk a little bit about deer behavior throughout the entire year, okay? Not only have you spent a lot of times in the tree stand, in the ground blind, running and gunning, whatever, you know, hunting, just hunting in general, hunting deer in general, but you also are out and about throughout all times of the year working on your farm, whether that's post-season, you know, hinge cutting or habitat work, whether that's planting food plots, whether that's any type of project around the farm throughout the non-hunting months. And so I thought you would be a good guest to bring in and talk about this. And I'm kind of curious, what I want to get out of this conversation today is something that you can identify in deer behavior that will tell you, A, hey, it's time to go hunting. You know, like things like, hey, it's time to get in the woods. Or, you know, maybe depending on how you feel about early season cold fronts, like, hey, so I have specific behaviors that I'm identifying through my deer herd that tell me when to get out of the woods, maybe when to stay out of the woods. And even on things like body language, and we talk about, oh shit, should I call it this buck? He already looks tense. Like, should I call at him? Things like, what are does doing this, you know, this time of year versus other times of year? And so let's just kick it off with maybe just some general comments about what you have witnessed throughout the years as a land manager and a straight up hunter. What you have identified as far as deer behavior is concerned.
Yeah, so I would say when I started in Michigan, I would go out early season. The deer would get pressured really, really early, and it would almost be like, I mean, it wasn't even reading the deer; it was just a pressure thing where I could go out the first few days of October and maybe see a few bucks on occasion. And then the whole October in Michigan, people would call it the October lull.
Yeah.
And you'd be like, there's nothing to do. There's no point in even hunting. And guys still do it and just ruin their ground and make the bucks essentially go nocturnal. And then you would jump back when it got cold during the rut. And then those bucks were, you know, clearly more aggressive, clearly more visible. But that was to tag a buck. That's basically any age class buck. And by the time I left Michigan, you know, it was maybe trying to shoot a three-year-old. And I mean, we shot some fully mature deer in Michigan, 5, 6, 7-year-old deer, which was, you know, when we got to southern Michigan, that was a little more natural and had a better age structure. But essentially, for maybe 15 years of hunting, I just hunted. I basically was like, listen, it's rut or nothing. That's when I'm going to shoot my deer. And calling was okay. Calling in Michigan, it's just a different dynamic, clearly, in Michigan. But I at least want to speak to that because so many people might be listening to this in areas that, you know, are similar to Michigan or Wisconsin or Minnesota or Pennsylvania. And I would say Michigan's probably the worst of all of them for age class and just the amount of pressure. But so that was the battle, is pressure. Well, I started coming out to the Midwestern states where there was a better age class, and I took some of my Michigan mindset with me, where I'm like, listen, you know, I'm in Iowa. I'm really just going to hunt the rut still. And it took me living here 5 years before I went, wait a minute, these deer are moving in daylight in October.
Yeah.
Mature bucks. And I wasn't even hunting. I'm like, no, we're going to leave the farm, because that's what you had to do, is leave the farm until the rut and then hit it hard. And I'd take off 2 weeks, you know, 3 weeks, and just hunt November. Well, now, you know, my hunting is 180 degrees different. You know, I don't even want to hunt the rut. I mean, I do, because it's fun,
yeah.
You know, and you get to see a lot of cool things. But as far as shooting mature buck, you know, all the things around that, it's not what I do. Now, in full context, I would say, you know, to the average hunter, I still think the rut in Iowa for the average hunter will be probably your best time if you're hunting like, hey man, I hunt ground without, you know, a lot of food and it's just timber, or I can't do food plots, or I'm hunting stuff with cattle pastures and I want to get a buck cruising through there. I still think that's the best time for your average, your average guy. But for a guy who maybe owns their own piece of land and that is working on habitat, growing the deer from a young age to an old age on even a smaller piece of ground, I want to get those deer moving in October, and I want to hunt them October in the cold fronts. And when I look at these deer in October, a lot of the dominant bucks, you know, and I'm in a fairly unique situation where I know the bucks. Mm-hmm. I kind of know their personalities. I know, you know, this one's really, really aggressive, and then I can generally pick that out while I look at them. And, you know, the amount of bucks I've shot on October 1st to maybe October 10 in the last maybe decade, and same with my brothers, I mean, it's probably 75%, that we've shot. Yeah, I'd say October 15, we've shot 75% of our big deer before that time. And it's usually, I mean, it's threading a needle, though. Mm-hmm. It's threading a needle, and it's looking. And a lot of times, and people don't believe this, or they might not believe it, but, well, I guess most do that know me. But, I mean, I call most of those deer in, even October, if they're out there a little bit. You know, and I'll read their body language, and they're just starting to get that aggression going in October, and their testosterone's starting to go up, and they're making scrapes. And there's another little buck out in the field, a 2 or 3-year-old or a dinker, whatever. He's pushing them off. He's saying, hey, just get out of here. Get out of here, dude. Yeah. I rule this. And then if I see that kind of behavior, which is usually the case, they're just setting up their dominance. They're saying this is my turf, and they just want them out of there. They're not looking to get in a complete brawl where they go bananas, but their aggression is coming out. Well, and then I will call to those deer and just watch their body language just with a lighter grunt. Yep. You know, saying, hey, there's another little buck in your turf. And for whatever reason, some guys would say, hey, I don't have good luck doing that. But, you know, if I do light grunts and watch your body language, more times than not, the majority of the time, I can call those deer in. Now, when I flip that around and say during the rut, I'm going to go blind rattle, which I don't do a lot. Mm-hmm. But when I do, I generally call in 2 and 3 year olds.
Yeah.
Maybe a 4 year old. Rarely do I pull in a mature deer.
Yeah.
Now people get overly aggressive with the rattling because they're like, man, every time I do it, a 2 and 3 year old runs in.
Mm-hmm.
If that's what you want to shoot, yeah, they're fairly dumb. They're a lot easier to hunt, and I think rattling's extremely successful, and they're just so aggressive by that time. But the only time I really have any luck during the rut is just catching them right where they're maybe doing some cruising, and I will visually see a mature buck, look at his body language, just look how he acts, and then I might grunt or hit the horns together and just immediately do it where I know he's not going to pick me off. And then just watch his body language. And you can tell in 10 seconds, that deer is zero interest. I'll know in 10 seconds he has zero interest to, he might start, it catches his attention. And then the best case is like, yeah, dude, he does not like what he just heard. He's going to come in and he's ready to tear stuff up. And you know, part of that is just timing. Is he with a doe? And part of it's deer personality as well, which clearly I think anybody listening to this would understand. You know, these deer definitely have different personalities, and some are more aggressive than others. Some of them are extremely timid. I don't care what time of year. I've had deer that I don't care when it is. I don't care if it's October, I don't care if it's November, they're just not that aggressive. And they're, you know, if I do a buck grunt, they don't want to come fight. They're just kind of, you know, more timid, just kind of like people. Mm-hmm. You know, some are super aggressive and they want to fight nonstop, and some of them just don't want any of it. Luckily, I would say most deer, the majority, fit into some level of aggression, though. So
yeah. So yeah. When you start to pick up the grunt tube or the rattling antlers, what specifically on a deer's body language are you looking for to say yes or no? Because to me it seems pretty binary. If a deer is doing this, I am going to call at him. If he is not doing this thing, then I'm not going to call at them. So as specific as possible, what indicators are you looking at as far as body language is concerned?
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I would say anything showing aggression where they're maybe making a scrape, a rub, whatever. If they're pushing off other bucks or just showing their dominance in any way that a buck is saying, this is my area, which could be any level of that, scrapes, rubs, pushing bucks off.
Yep.
Starting to check out the does, just going up to that doe and saying, hey, anywhere close to the time of partying? Nope. You know, and they might, and if they get on a doe, you know, you're done. Most of the time I have, if they're on a doe, there's just almost no chance.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, if there's anything like they're kind of on pins and needles, there's, you know, clearly like deer blowing at something. You know, there's a bobcat out and you see a bunch of other deer running off. I mean, you know, I won't do it then, clearly, if they're on any kind of alert, clearly if they're downwind or something like that. And if they were downwind and, you know, this is the last day I'm going to hunt and I'm never going to see this buck again, and he's about to leave, you know, that's your Hail Mary.
Yeah.
But the chance of success is pretty minimal. So
yeah,
any level of aggression, I like calling. And
yeah,
and that's in any natural situation when the deer isn't on high alert. I mean, I have a very, very good success rate calling deer. I mean, very good.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, when I was younger, I certainly didn't. So yeah, I mean, you know, I think that's pretty much it. Just yeah, any level of aggression to try a few different things without getting busted.
Yeah. I'll tell you this, in 2021, was it 2020 or 2021? I think one of those years, I forget what year it was. Anyway, I'm setting up my tree stand. I walk in off this ridge point and I get in the tree stand. I'm pulling up my hang on and this 3-year-old 10-pointer walks right underneath of me and he starts to make some scrapes and rub some trees a little bit. And I knew I wasn't in there for that buck. I was in there for this really wide 24-inch wide buck that I ended up killing that night. But I got trail camera information that triangulated his position with the right wind. I moved off this ridge point and I saw a buck in a field. I didn't know what buck it was, so I put the horns together. And this is after that 10-pointer had left. And that buck in the field stops, turns right towards me, and he's like this 140, 145-inch 10-pointer that I just wasn't too jacked about. But I hear something up on the top of the ridge, and it's the wide buck that I was after, rubbing a tree, making scrapes, and just like thrashing. It wasn't just rubbing, it was thrashing this tree. And I knew right then that this is a potential callable deer. I just needed other deer to kind of go away at that point before I called him. And so I ended up doing a grunt. He wasn't too concerned with any grunt that I laid on him. He was too close, I felt, to rattle. And so I snort wheezed at him. And eventually that two snort wheezes is what brought him in and I shot him. But I watched his body language. I knew he was in an aggressive attitude. He had an aggressive attitude, and that's what ultimately killed him at that point. And so now I just snort wheezed in a 5-year-old who at the time I believe was the dominant buck in the system of ridges that I hunt. So it's calling is one of those things where I would say you kind of hit on it there. It's the body language is the most important thing. If you see a buck by himself and he's just kind of trotting along, more than likely, in my experience, that grunt won't stop him if he's, you know, if it looks like he's on a mission. But if he's meandering a little bit and it's a slower pace, things like calling probably, may or may not work.
Yeah, I tried it this November. I had a little satellite farm that an absolute giant buck showed up at. And I finally saw him, but it was, I mean, I put in a lot of time.
Yeah.
And I saw him in November and he's with a doe both times.
Yeah.
And I mean, he was, you know, it was Hail Mary.
Mm-hmm.
And that deer, he heard me calling. I threw everything at him and I knew before I called. I just knew it was a 1 in 100 chance I could get him to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly that one didn't work out.
Right.
And that was an all in effort on a giant, giant buck that I have no idea what happened to him. I don't know where this deer came from on a little tiny farm. And those are the stories you don't hear about. Like, yeah, I spent a good chunk of my season hunting this deer. It didn't work out. I came up empty.
Yeah.
And my calling came up empty.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I've had two giants you know, I mean, two 200s that I had come out in October, and I had one that was a 7-year-old buck, and he got close to coming in, and then he got where he was going to go out to this big ag field, and he was about to hop the fence, and I noticed there was a little buck under my tree stand, like a little 6-point, but he was sitting right out in the open, and I thought, I'm going to try this. So I grunted, light grunt. Well, he looks my way, and that little buck was sitting under there, and that little buck, I didn't spook him, and I know that little buck was probably thinking, hey, man, this wasn't me. And that buck came from 300 yards away to beat the crap out of, or to basically get out of here, this little buck. And when he saw that buck coming, he's like, uh-oh. And he quick got out of the way, and that giant went 15 yards where that little buck was, bumping him off, and he got an arrow. And the following year, in the middle of the timber, I had another one that was a 7-year-old buck, another giant. And I had the same thing. It doesn't clearly work out like this, but just coincidentally, same thing. I had a little buck under me, and this buck pops up a couple hundred yards away cruising for does. And this was actually later in the season. He was cruising, and he sees this little buck too. And again, I didn't spook that little buck. So 2 years in a row, I used the little natural little buck right by my tree stand to be the decoy for me, to be the bait. And I grunted, and 2 years in a row, a grunt tube and a little buck below my stand got me two giant bucks.
Yeah.
So you just things line up like that sometimes, and then that may never happen again. It happened 2 years in a row, and that certain circumstance might never happen again.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's something, you know, what's better than just sound? Visual. Right. You had an opportunity where you made the grunt, the other buck heard it, and now he has the visual that there's other deer in the area. So now he's coming in to investigate, which that may not have been that particular deer's, the big buck's body language, but it was an indicator to him that there was other deer in the area. And that would be a good time to call. Except, and I've had this exact scenario happen because it's worked for me the exact same way that you said it. However, if a little buck is doing it now, if there's a doe close by,
just going to say that.
Exactly. Right. I mean, they don't look, they don't let anything slide. Their head just goes whoop, point that, like, they peg you instantly. And so, when it comes to, let's talk about does now, body language of does. If you see something, let's say there's a buck way down and you're thinking about calling at this buck, but somehow a doe gets in between you, are you disregarding anything that the buck is doing or showing just because there is basically an alert doe or any type of doe group in front of you?
So I think if I had to take my best, wildest guess at it, you know, when I say, hey, there was two dinker bucks below me and I could call and get away with it, well, they're year and a half old bucks. Yeah. And you can look at their antlers and say, that's a year and a half old buck. He's not smart.
Yeah.
So I knew I would get away with it with year and a half olds. Now, in theory, deer just being deer, and I realize does are different than bucks, clearly, but if I knew that it was a very young doe that wasn't real smart, just like that year and a half old, maybe I could get away with it. But the problem with the doe, you generally don't quite know. And let's just, you know, run averages on it. Most of those does out there are probably 3, 4, 5, who knows? Mm-hmm. And then you get these, you know, 5, 6, 7-year-old does. Well, even if that was a buck, they're going to be a totally different animal.
Right.
Than a year and a half old buck. So, yeah, if I've got these big, huge, you know, blocky head does out there that are just nasty, mean old things, they're smart. They're the ones that blow at you, that figure it all out.
Exactly.
You know, like, I want to shoot that sucker because they get you.
Yeah.
So if it's that type of deer, I think you're just, you know, you're just at such a higher risk level of screwing something up versus, you know, a year and a half old buck, yeah, which is just dumber than dumb.
Yeah.
Yeah, the does are tricky. And and here's the thing with does is that buck might be, it's a buck. It's one buck. When you have a doe, it's rarely one doe. It's usually four, five, six of them.
Mm-hmm.
So now you certainly don't have four, five, and six year-and-a-half-old does. By definition, some of those are older does that have been around the block.
Yep.
They know danger. They're gonna get you.
Yeah.
Just your probability of alerting them and causing issues is just far greater with the larger group of does. And
yeah,
it's screwed up. Every single person that's listening to this, that group of does has screwed up multiple hunts. And, you know, and also that's what makes us fun, too, because it's another challenge.
Right. And that's crazy because at the farm that you helped me load my buck in this year, that there's a doe group there that I have never seen the old, I guess, alpha doe or whatever, you know, the head of the group. Probably about four generations of her offspring in this doe group with her. I've never seen her put her head down to eat. She comes out and she stands head up and all she does is look around while the other does are eating. It is absolutely crazy. I'm like, okay, her head's going to go down. She's going to eat now. Nope. She may. It's almost like she does it sometimes to fake you out where she'll go down and put her head like she's eating and then she'll look back up around. But she never eats. And so it's crazy that these older age class deer, male or female, have this cunningness to them that allows them to just be on point and take zero risks.
Yeah, they're survivors.
Yeah.
It's just a totally different animal.
Yeah.
I mean, If you ran the numbers on, you know, how hard it is to kill a 5, 6, 7-year-old deer, I mean, you know, you think of how many to get a shot at, say, like a 6-year-old deer. By definition, unless you get lucky, which clearly just happened, you're going to be passing, you know, dozens of year and a half old deer, and then 10, you know, whatever. I mean, 50 deer probably are going to get passed before you get a crack at one
yep.
deer that's 6 years old.
Yep.
And I mean, I look back historically at like, hey, I shot a 7-year-old deer and how many other younger bucks had walked by me where if I would have shot a younger buck, I would have been tagged out, you know, way earlier. So, you know, just the chance at those older class deer, they're just a totally different animal and they're just so much harder to hunt and shoot. And clearly they're a far more rare animal too. I mean, not as much so with does. I would say there's a lot of does on my farm that are, you know, 6 to 12, maybe 14 years old. Who knows? They're ancient. There's some ancient does out there. And we shoot some too, but it's just so hard to follow an age of a doe.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, the amount, even on farms where you're like, hey, this farm is in a really great area, a really great state, a really great region, the amount of, you know, 5, 6, 7-year-old bucks on that farm is so minuscule. It's so tiny. And they're generally, because they're such, you know, all their buddies have got picked off for years and, hey, all my friends are dead, yeah, and I'm the last one standing. They're sharp.
Yeah.
It's just a different animal to hunt.
Yeah.
Now, if you can figure out their natural home range and get them comfortable in that, and one advantage to the older deer is their home range is absolutely shrink, which is nice. And, you know, people would say, well, that makes them easier. Yes and no. You know, the guys that want to hunt the rut and get a deer that's traveling or, you know, want to bounce around all over the place, it makes it really hard. And their bedding to food areas are so minimal that you're kind of threading a needle and, you know, it's so easy to bump those deer too. So it's kind of double-edged sword.
Yeah.
But these older age class deer, just it's a totally different strategy on how I hunt them.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I want to go back to something that you mentioned earlier, and that's about, you know, in Michigan, whenever you would, there was a lot of pressure early on in the season right away.
Insane. You've been in Iowa your whole life, right?
Right, right.
Oh, people in Iowa complain about the pressure, and it is a lot. Don't misunderstand.
Yeah.
Iowa, you know, getting permission on farms, extremely hard. Iowa, what it is today versus 10 and 20 years ago, it's much harder. I was not what it was 10 and 20 years ago. It's just not.
Hey, 1 second. Iowa's prime. I'm going to throw a number out. I want you to throw a number out. I'm guessing the prime, somewhere between 95, 97, somewhere right in there, almost up to the two, like up to 1999.
Yeah. If I had to put a pin on the date, I would call it 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Coincidentally,
yeah,
that's when the deer population was the highest in Iowa.
Yeah.
And I would say if we got a little further into the weeds here, from the 90s to the early 2000s, the upper two-thirds of the state where there's just smaller amounts of woods, or even now there's no woods,
yeah,
you know, they've dozed every last bit of it out. I would say the heyday there was the 90s into the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And now you look at those areas and you're like, yeah. I mean, I remember in the northern two-thirds of Iowa where I would say every county, if I had to guess, and this is based on a lot of experience and knowing people all over the place, but I would say there was a 200-inch deer in even all the ag counties in the state. There was a 200-inch deer that somebody could hunt in, you know, a few of them in every county.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'd say, you know, there's counties where there's not a 200-inch deer in the whole county for multiple years.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of folks that are like, dude, I don't even have deer to hunt. There's no deer. There's three of them over here, and there's one buck I maybe see. I mean, it's totally different there. But,
yeah,
you know, statewide in the heavily timbered areas, I would say it, which is very little, but I would say that peaked out around 2005. And then we had two major things happen. And this is major. We had three major things happen. We had massive EHD outbreaks, which have absolutely devastated the herd,
mm-hmm,
which we need to put more research and funding into solving EHD. I think it's far more significant than CWD, far more significant, and it wipes herds out. So we've had massive EHD outbreaks. We've had a political lobby that has wanted to eradicate the deer, kill them all, and they have cut the numbers in half. The harvest numbers have gone in half. So that's another huge, I mean, that's half the amount of bucks now.
Yep.
I mean, does are kicking out half bucks. So there's literally half the amount of bucks being shot. And then the third thing that, in my opinion, has really hurt in Iowa and just taken it down several notches from its glory days is just the amount of people that just want to go out there now and pound it for 4 months and they have to get their buck. And I got to have my buck to post on social media. And you know, when I was younger, maybe I had that pressure. I don't anymore. And I'm not saying I don't understand it, because I do. But I think it's a problem. And I wish, you know, I wish it wasn't quite like that. And I would encourage people, don't hunt to get a buck to post. Don't.
Yeah.
That's not why we hunt. Hunt for the experience, you know.
Yeah.
And I've preached on this before, but, you know, don't hunt for a buck to post. You will not like hunting as well. But I think that's been a huge driver. All these people that are like, man, I watch YouTube videos. I see the guys posting the big bucks on Facebook and Instagram. I got to get a buck to post. And then they end up shooting stuff that it's like, dude, you shot the best 2 or 3 year old in the neighborhood. And there are mature deer. And then it's just a downward spiral. So there's been three really big things, you know, the EHD, the population decline, and all these dudes that are just out there pounding it because I got to get a buck to post. And there's a lot of guys that don't do that. Don't misunderstand. There's a lot of guys that are like, dude, I hunt because I freaking love it. I freaking love it. And, you know, I just,
I knew I shouldn't have asked you that question, because now we're going down a completely different path.
But that's fun.
Yeah.
That's fun.
Yeah.
That keeps things interesting. We can go down whatever path you want. My mind goes all over.
I know it does.
During the day.
I know it does.
I was just talking to somebody earlier today. You know, it's a rain day. Well, for farmers being a rain day, my phone has just rang all day. Mm-hmm. All day, just nonstop. And yesterday, when it was dry out, it wasn't like that. I mean, it would ring quite a bit. But granted, I had my phone off. Mm-hmm. Today, my phone has just rang off the stinking hook. Hey, I want to talk to you about this farming stuff. I want to talk to you about this project. I want to talk to you about this whatever. And it's all farm-related, deer-related, habitat-related, getting corn and beans in related, whatever. But, yeah, so my brain has just my job now. I just got done talking to a buddy about this. Maybe he's watching this, but I'm like, we're going on all these different topics on farming, and I do a lot of projects with the guy and help him out. I said to him, hey, Zach, I said, this is what ADHD is, because we had covered like 20 different topics in an hour, knocking out different projects. And I would say I have an ADHD mind. With all these farming and all the different dynamics that go into whitetails, there's so many different facets to it, and that's what I like about it.
Yeah.
And I understand that most people don't take it to that extreme, or want to take it to that extreme. I just like it, you know. Yeah. You know, I just got back from looking at some Kansas farms, and I actually bought a farm in Kansas, and I walked on. You know, I had some buddies that wanted me to see their farms. I had some guys that wanted to sell their farms, and I walked on about 20 farms, and I'm not joking. 20 out of 20 of them had either a spin corn feeder, or one of the ones that they're timed and they put 100 pounds in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's timed to put out a couple, you know, it puts out 3 pounds of corn every time the timer goes off or something, and a ground blind or a ladder stand just looking at a corn feeder 15 yards away. Now, I'm just like, that's it? That's what you do? That's it. They don't do food plots. They're not hunting trails. They're not checking out scrape lines. They're not doing timber stand improvement. They're not doing anything to the farm. And I would say half of those, they're like, yeah, well, it's in this cattle pasture where the ground's destroyed. So I build this fence around this corn feeder, like a woven wire fence, and so the cattle can't get into it. And then I put my blind outside of that fence, and I wait till the deer are coming to hop in to get the corn out of the feeder, and I shoot them right before they hop into this fence. And I'm not knocking these people. I'm not. But I'm like, how is that enjoyable? Seriously. And It kind of drove me nuts. Like, dude, really? And I asked one of the guys with a smile on my face. I'm like, do you like doing this? Seriously? I'm not the guy who's like, that's not hunting. You're not a hunter. I'm not that guy, okay? But I asked him, I'm like, how do you enjoy this? And I did ask another question. I did say, listen, I've been on 20 farms now where all they do is throw out corn piles. And when I go back to Iowa, we're doing timber stand improvement. We're improving the soil. We're planting native grasses like crazy. We are doing everything we can to add the nutrition across the whole farm, to do conservation practices, to try and think, what can I do to make, you know, my ground better for whitetails, for the whole ecology, for even birds, even if you don't hunt them, whatever, for everything. We're throwing huge amounts of effort, work, money into making these farms a conservation dream and making them better. And in Kansas, they don't have that incentive to do that because everybody's just programmed. No, dude, I'm not going to do all that stuff. I'm not. I'm just going to throw out a corn pile. And that whole state suffers because of it. The whole ecosystem suffers because of that. Because guys just have an easy button. And they don't have to do all this other work that we have to do up here because we can't throw out corn piles. And, you know, it's just something I observed. It's not, I'm not just doing this to stir the pot. I'm not.
Yeah.
But I just saw this with my own eyes on 20 Farms, and I just said, you know what? I said it to my buddy. I said, dude, don't you think this is kind of lame? He's like, yeah, it kind of is. And I said, you know, whatever. I'm not telling him not to do it. I don't care. But I said, do you realize how much better your state would be for everybody, for the whole ecosystem, if you guys removed that crap and actually fixed your farms up and made them, you know, exceptional habitat, exceptional browse, didn't graze them down to the ground and just throw out corn piles. And then here's another one is I don't turkey hunt. And these guys are like, yeah, we don't really have hardly any turkeys. I mean, there's a few. It's maybe a tenth of what it was. And this was in 5 different counties. They're like, yeah, our turkey numbers are way down. I said, yeah, dude, do you know why? No, they're just way down. People are shooting too many. I said, no. I said, you guys are supplementing the largest raccoon population in the country with these corn piles. You guys are growing. You guys probably have multiple world record raccoons. Because your feeders are sitting there with 20 raccoons under them, and you're doing nothing to kill the coons. And you're supplementing all these raccoons. And they're killing all your turkeys. So there's another one. And I said, here, you know, and then we got into, you really think that? I said, dude, of course that's a huge component. You guys have probably the largest raccoon population in the world with these corn piles. And the other thing is, and I, this will be controversial, but I'll at least make this. I said, the other problem is you guys are putting these corn piles out, massive corn piles that are, you know, a lot of them were 2-3 feet deep when they just dump corn out. And then they're getting full of the aflatoxins. And these critters are eating the corn with aflatoxins, and it's killing them. And they don't realize that one. But I said, you know, the bigger one is, yeah, dude, you guys have 50 billion raccoons. I don't know how a turkey has a nest. Maybe the strategy is to make sure you put out corn piles during turkey nesting season so they leave the eggs alone. But, I mean, it's created a lot of problems out there. So just a minor – side tangent. Sorry to take us off.
No, that's right. I just let you go. I just let you go because it's impossible to wrangle them, you know, certain people in when they keep going. Just let them finish, and then I'll slightly nudge us back towards the original conversation.
My wife has this talent too. Uh-oh, here he goes on this tangent.
Yeah.
Hey, well, I need to talk to you about this. Yeah.
I get it. Yeah. Before we went down that path, I wanted
to. But hey,
okay,
hey,
here we go.
This does fit into reading buck behavior and calling to deer, though.
Okay.
Because in Kansas, you throw all that out the window. You don't have to worry about it. You just sit on your corn pile and wait till they're at 15 yards and blast them.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't got to worry about that in Kansas. Yeah. So that does it. This does mesh up.
Let me ask you a question here. What is the difference between a bait pile and a concentrated food plot?
A lot of things. A bait pile will be, because I hear this all the time, a bait pile and a food plot are the same thing. Okay. Any food plot that I ever do, if it's going to be even mildly successful, aside from maybe a few clover plots, is going to be, let's call it an acre in size, roughly 42,000 square feet. A corn pile is 10 square feet, and it's a big pile of corn. Well, my 1 acre food plot, which most of mine are far bigger than that, most of them are, if I want a corn plot, it's generally 10 acres, which is clearly 420,000 square feet. So my 10 acre corn plot is 42,000 times larger than a bait pile. 42,000 times the space. Now, do they have the same desired outcome? Yes and no, because I plant a lot of food plots purely for nutrition. I don't care if I even hunt over them. Nobody's putting out a corn pile for nutrition. Sorry, they're not. Now, the other thing is with a food plot, when that corn in my cornfield or beans or whatever, when it's eaten, it's gone. I can't go throw more on it, right? a corn pile, I can just keep putting it in the same spot and replenishing and replenishing. And these deer are just hitting this 10 square foot area over and over and over. And then all the, I'm not going to say CWD because I honestly don't buy into the whole CWD discussion, but the bacterial issues, some of the viral issues when you get into a 10 square foot area are just amplified big time. Where when you're talking, let's just say 1 acre, 42,000, whatever, I might be off a little bit, 42,000 square feet. That is 4,200 times larger. It's spreading those deer out over a massive area compared to a 10 square foot bait pile. Mm-hmm. And again, once that food source is gone, if they ate it, you're done. You know, you have to plan it right. You have to do enough of it to sustain them. There's a long list of differences between food plots and bait piles, just a long list. So, you know, my food plots done correctly, I mean, they're still, you know, even my rye mixes and my clovers, they're all greened up right now. If I did corn piles, like, you know, some of the states allow, and again, I'm not sitting here trying to knock these people. I'm not. I would at least like them to consider things because I like listening to opposing points of view with me on any issue. I like hearing them. I think dialogue is good. I don't want to silence other people. I like hearing dissenting voices. But I would just say to those people, you know, let's just be real about it. When hunting season is done, you guys quit putting out the corn piles. Well, when you do food plots, that's continually feeding the deer after the season. When they need it the most, when it's February and it's negative 10 degrees out, they have the sustenance, they have the food sources available on my farm to survive and to be healthier. And I'm not just throwing out a corn pile. And if I did just throw out a corn pile in February, it would probably be fairly detrimental to the deer, as opposed to getting woody browse that they're ready to digest, that is more digestible. And clearly, if you throw a starving deer corn, there's problems with that too. But you know, you've got stuff with food plots where they're growing back, they're stopping erosion, they're improving the soil, like clovers and alfalfas and hay mixes and rye mixes. They're actually improving the soil. They're building the soil. They're building the organic matter. They're benefiting other wildlife. You know, birds can eat the insects in there. You know, there's all these benefits to food plots. And I mean, this, I could go on for a half hour on the benefits of food plots, and diversity of food plots. And that's a key. It's not just one food plot. It's a diversity of food plots. There's a list 50 things long that I could say, this is what food plots do to help the ecosystem, to help, wildlife and hunting. And, you know, and is part of that, do some people use food plots to shoot deer over? Sure. But a corn pile, that's the only reason they're doing it. That's the only reason, is an easy button to shoot deer over it. Mm-hmm. And it's just like coming with all, you know, without all of the other benefits of food plots. And I would just ask, you know, respectfully, I'm not trying to be a jerk. I'm not. But I would just respectfully ask, what are the other benefits to a corn pile? You're not helping the nutrition of the animals out there. You're not doing it for the ecosystem and the birds and all the other things. You're doing it just to shoot a deer over it with all the negative downsides to it. So I find with corn piles, I find one upside. That's deer easier to shoot. Period. End of story. Done. With everything else, you can point to multiple different benefits, yeah, with very little downside. You know, you're not, and even with the diseases and the aflatoxins with corn, people don't even understand that stuff. What's an aflatoxin? Yeah, go Google it. Aflatoxins in corn. When you have all these funguses and mold that come on the corn, and these animals eat it, and you're killing probably large amounts of animals doing it, there's all these negative sides to it. And I would just ask somebody, what's the negative sides of food plots? Done correctly, there really isn't any. I mean, maybe a few, but...
Pulling deer off other people's property?
That's a problem. That's a problem. And if it's... And there, we know these distasteful lines. We know where they are. Like, you know, I've seen it where it's like, there's a a pasture farm without a tree on it. It hasn't been hunted for 50 years. Nobody goes out there. There's no hunting value. They're contributing nothing. It's overrun cattle that are in there, and somebody figures out, oh, the guy over here has been working for years to have really great deer hunting. I'll just go put a food plot on that guy's fence in the cattle pasture, keep the cattle out of this part, and just shoot everything that hops the fence. Now, you know, there's a line there that I think, in my opinion, has been crossed when people take advantage of situations like that and just want to capitalize on somebody else's hard work. Now, there's situations like, you know, yeah, I've hunted this cattle pasture forever. There's some trees on it, and I like to do a little bit of hunting. But they're not sitting there with the mindset, I'm just going to get on that dude's fence to wait till the deer hop, and I just want to take. You know, I think you know it when you see it. I can't define it. And people are going to do whatever they want anyway. So I'm not going to change any in the outcome here at all. I'm just explaining just one schmuck's opinion.
Hey, dude, I've identified a stud farm and then knocked on somebody's door to hunt it because it bordered another person's farm. You know the whole story.
Yeah.
Right? And
yeah,
so,
absolutely.
But as a hunter looking for property, I don't necessarily see anything wrong with getting access to a property or owning a property and then going, holy cow, man, he's doing some great things over here. I'm going to do one of those things, and that is plant a food plot, right? Because I want to pull deer off and help sustain them throughout the years.
So I don't have a problem with that at all. And again, there's these lines where you have to look yourself in the mirror and say, you know when that line's crossed, right? If you said, hey, there's a guy over here with a 500-acre farm that's legit. It is awesome. And there's an 80 next to it, and that 80 has timber. It's got some crops. Well, that 80 with timber and crops is contributing to the deer. And for you to say, yeah, some of the deer do live on that 80 acres or spend a good amount of time there, and I want to hunt there, and I happen to have a great neighbor, who could fault that? I don't fault that. I think that's logical.
Yeah.
But if I were to say there's a guy with 500 acres, same situation, same farm. And, dude, there's just a fence there, and there's just this wide-open nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. It doesn't sustain one deer, and I'm not going to do a darn thing to it except plant a food plot there so I can just sit there and wait for the deer to hop the fence from the 500-acre guy's farm. That's a different case in my mind, and I think most people would be like, yeah. And one of those examples, you know, that 80 acres, maybe you do some things to it. Maybe you put in do some habitat work, or, you know, you leave the forest there, which is contributing to things. So there's just this level of, hey, you're giving a little bit, right? You're hunting a farm that is sustaining the deer, that is housing the deer, where the deer want to live on, that spend a good amount of their time on. You didn't doze the timber. You're contributing. And there's a lot of people who are willing to give some, you know, hey, I want my ground to be better. I'm willing to do these things to it for the betterment of everybody. Those are givers. Mm-hmm. You know, at some level you're giving. And I just think in society in general, you have people, a minority of the people, but there is some people where all they want in life is just to take. And I don't mind people that take, well, I took a deer over here. That's great. But if all you do is take, if all you do, all your mindset is somebody else did the work, I want to capitalize on all their work. I don't want to do the work. I just want to take advantage of every situation where somebody else is. And I just want to take because it's all about me. That's a line for me that I'm not comfortable with. That I could never do that, you know. And I just find I would call that just an ethical issue, you know. It's legal, so if you're going to do that, somebody's listening, he's an asshole. Not meaning to be. You can still do it, though. You know, do I think, with a smile on my face, do I think if you take it to that extreme and you're the guy that just take, do I think that's kind of an asshole move? Sure, I do. I don't care. You can still do it, though. I'm not sitting here trying to cause debates and cause people to get pissed off at me, and they do, that's fine. But I think you know these magic lines, and I think we know situations where, these guys are just out to take, and they're just out for them, And I understand the landowners that are like, listen, man, I'm working all year long trying to just get a one or two deer every once in a while to maturity. And I got these neighbors that just, you know, I take $1 or $2 a year and they shoot every frickin' one they can. They will shoot every one they see, and then they'll get another group of buddies or family members or a paid hunter, and they'll shoot another pile of them, you know. And I've seen it where a guy has 500 acres, and I'm making this example up, just like I'll just keep the 500-acre one. The 500-acre guy's like, listen, I'm taking one mature buck off of the year, that's about all that's there, one. And the neighbors over there are shooting 5 and 10 bucks a year. It's like off of 80 acres. And I see that a lot. It's like, is that right? You know, it's legal. It's legal. And I'm not going to say, you know, yes or no definitively, but I think you could ask that question and I'll let somebody else answer that for themselves. To me, I couldn't do that. I couldn't own 80 acres next to 500 and be like, yep, we took 10 bucks off of there. Everyone that hopped the fence, we shot it. I would feel guilty about that. But it's just like anything that people take advantage of, whether it's, you know, government handouts or, you know, anything. There's going to be people that want to just take, and others that want to give. And I would just hope for more people to have a little bit self-reflective approach to that. And the more people that are giving, it's just going to lift everyone up. It's why I want to help my neighbors make their farms better. You know, they want to give. They want, and guess what? When my neighbors want to give, I want to help them too. I'm willing to give to them. Yeah. I'm not just giving to my farm. I'll give my time, my resources, and my effort to my neighbors because they're good people. And, you know, it's not a zero-sum game. It's not, there's always just a definitive amount of mature bucks and it can only be this much. No, if more guys are doing this stuff, it's just better for everybody. So, you know, I just think that giving mindset and thinking beyond ourselves for hunting, having a little bit of balance. It doesn't need to be, you know, I own all the deer and you can't shoot anything unless it's 10 years old and it's 300 inches. I'm not saying that, but I think a balance of, you know, it's not just about me. It is a shared resource. You know, these deer aren't owned by me, but in the same breath, this is a shared resource. So I feel like I have a responsibility to not go shoot everyone I can and bring everyone in here I can and just shoot everything brown it's down. And, you know, I want it to be sustainable and be better for others. And if I passed a deer, you know, that's a great deer. It's not what I want. That's going to be a memory for somebody else that shoots that deer if I don't shoot them, you know. And maybe it's a kid getting his first buck. Hey, I passed that deer because it's not about me. And some kid has a memory of a lifetime and shoots that deer. So, you know, just because I don't take that deer does not mean that's, you know, I didn't have success, because that deer getting to an older age class or even some kid down the road, it runs by him and he gets it. I think there's a value in that to me.
So what about the guys that are on that 80 acres who take 10 bucks off of it every year? And obviously they're not on the same level as you are, or that are on that 500 acres that, let's say, is managed. And then you have the 80 acres sitting next to it that is obviously not managed, but it is a place for people to go hunting. And maybe there's so many people that hunt that because they can't find anywhere else to go, especially in Southern Iowa, where outfitters, leasing, all that stuff plays a big part.
Yeah, I think I understand that. And I would just say to any of these people, you know, do what you want. You know, if you want to shoot 10 bucks out there, good for you. If it's legal, you know, I'm not saying it's fine, because anything that, well, it's just because it's legal, it's good. No, I don't think that's the case in countless examples. There's countless things in society that are legal, that are not moral, right, advised, ethical, whatever. But I think these people could understand, you know, most of them know the guy with the 500 acres is not shooting 10 bucks. And I think any of them with just a drop of common sense would say, you know, if they talk to their neighbor, which I think is advisable, talk to your neighbor. I'm guessing the guy with 500 acres is not shooting 10 bucks. So if you with 80 acres is shooting 10 bucks, do you think that's right? And you got to answer that yourself. I think there's two answers to that. I think if people think about it, they're going to go, you know, it's not really balanced. That's not really probably the right thing to do. And I respect my neighbor enough to not have to just take from all the hard work he's done, all the benefits. And then I think there's another, you know, so, and I think they understand that. And maybe they adjust their thinking. And then I think there's the reality of there's a portion of people who don't care. I don't care.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've watched it. I've watched people go to in every community I've been in, there's been a local pond around that, you know, everybody can fish there. And you'll get some jackass that will just, you know, take everything he can take. And it's like, dude, this is a community area. Yeah, the legal bag limits on fish are this, but dude, it's a finite resource, okay? You don't need to take every fish out every day that you catch. And eventually, you know, everybody else, there might be 20 guys that fish that pond or 20 people, including kids. And eventually it gets so bad that I may have to move again. I got the cleaning crew here, but, you know, it'll get to the point where, you know, 20 people will say, hey, one guy or one group of people took so many out of here that, you know, the fishing's no good. It's destroyed. So, and it's kind of a human nature discussion, too. You know, we see this play out all over the place with loggers, with, you know, with farmers. The farmers that just have to, it's their land, but they have to farm right into the creek. Right to the creek bank. Do you really need to do that? Is it all about the last little bit you can take? Again, it's just givers and takers in society.
Yeah.
And as hunters, you know, where I think this discussion is slightly different is when we're into hunting, we do it because we love it. I would say most people. It's exciting. We make memories. We feed ourselves, too. I would say, you know, if I just wanted to feed myself and I just ran the economics, I'd be better off just raising a cow or going to the grocery store, to be honest. I hunt for meat. Yeah, I do. I do. I eat venison every day, a pound of it, usually deer sticks. But, you know, there's a whole sustainability and a tradition and a culture around hunting and, you know, wanting to get the kids into it. Because it's such a pure, great thing for kids to get into as opposed to all the other junk. Well, if we want our kids to be involved in the outdoors and hunting, we have to leave a quality experience and we have to leave a quality resource for our kids. And when we just take from it and degrade a resource, whether it's, you know, it's the farm ground where all the topsoil is gone because we just massacred it, or, you know, polluted the water, or we killed everything because, you know, we had to take every fish and we had to shoot every deer. You know, it hurts the whole resource. And I would just make the argument that when we hurt the resource and we destroy the quality, we're taking opportunities away from the next generation, from kids who could be captivated in hunting or fishing and maybe get themselves out of drugs and alcohol problems or lifestyles. I mean, I'll be honest, like this is going crazy different directions here, but had I not got into hunting, obviously people will pick up pretty quick. I have an intense personality. I mean, who knows what I would have got into without hunting? You know, who knows? I mean, I could have got into bad stuff, and hunting kept me extremely grounded. It's been a passion of mine since I was a little kid, just being outdoors. And just with this intense personality, which I would say there's a fair bit of hunters with kind of intense personalities, that they're going to get into something. And I just hope for these kids, that for our society, that these kids get into hunting and fishing and outdoors because I think it will be better for, you know, for a resource, for our environment, for our culture, than, yeah, man, more kids are just getting into drugs and alcohol and problems and, you know, social issues and, you know, like they're screwed up in school and, you know, so I just think having a quality resource and having a resource we don't just take and we want to make it better has benefits throughout society that just ripple throughout society and make a more wholesome, well-founded culture.
Yeah.
So, I mean, me without hunting, man, I'd be doing a documentary right now behind bars and I'd be like, yeah, I robbed these five banks and here's my story. I got away with four of them. So how'd you get caught on your, I mean, that could be my story, something like that. But I got into hunting and farming and,
well, this far into the podcast, I'm going to have to rename it. I was going to call it like Unpacking Deer Behavior or something like that. And I think we only talked about deer behavior for like 10 minutes and it's here we're going on an hour.
Unpacking Skip's Behavior.
Yeah. I think I'll just call it Derailed, right? Again.
Derailed. I love it.
Again,
I love
or something it. Like that. But I do want to finish out on a deer behavior question, right? Way at the beginning of this podcast, you mentioned something about, you know, spooking deer and them going nocturnal. Why don't you share your thoughts and experiences on what you believe a mature buck will do when he is spooked, whether that's by a hunter or by a predator of some sort?
I would say you've got two or three times of spooking that deer. And hey, I know, cause I have bucks on my farm that I have down to, I have some, nobody would believe this. Most people wouldn't believe this unless they see it. I have deer that live in 20 to 40 acres. And I mean, I can run a trail camera on the 50 acres, the 10 acres past it and never get them on trail camera, almost including during the rut. The rut is the exception where I'm like, that deer definitely vanished for 3 days. Mm-hmm. But I have deer that don't even cover 40 acres. Now, if I bump that deer and he knows I'm a threat, like hunting, shooting at him, whatever, he, you know, I'm in a tree stand and he pegs me. If I bust him two times, maybe three, something drastically is going to change in his behavior. If I bust him walking into a stand where he was bedding two or three times, he will relocate. And it might not be to another farm, but he's going to drastically change what he was doing. And that's why the early season hunting is threading a needle. You know, they're very short travel patterns. And your chance of bumping that deer because, you know, you're trying to tuck right up to where he's bedding. You are threading a needle. And, you know, you bump him a couple times, it's game over. You're not going to get him early season. That's why early season, I love it, and I'm that's when I'm mostly successful. But I would say, you know, there's the most risk there. It's extremely hard to pull that off. Threading a needle is the best way I can put it. If you don't thread that needle correctly, you could maybe make a mistake once. You bump that deer two or three times in any fashion. You know, I bumped him going in, or you know, he came out in the wrong spot and he got downwind of me. You're done. You know, if that happens two times, you're done. You need to redo your whole strategy. You probably will kill him out of another spot. He probably will shift. Now, if I had five guys that were hunting my farm and we were aggressively competing for that deer, which I grew up on a lot of farms where guys looked at it as a competition. I got to get that deer. And these guys are, I mean, I've seen it all. I've seen dudes messing with other guys' setups. I mean, I just got sick of all that stuff, the hunter drama and push in. You know, I know the wind's wrong, but if I don't hunt for them, somebody else is going to get them. And, I mean, that's not even fun for me. I didn't even like that. But I've been around it forever. Mm-hmm. When that happens, you know, five guys are going in there going nuts. It usually just ruins it. Mm-hmm. And then it just becomes a crapshoot. It just becomes kind of the equivalent of a rut hunt. where who knows where he's going to show up now, because you're just shuffling them all over the place. And when there's five guys doing it, you know, or a large group that's putting massive pressure on a mature deer, you will push him off that farm. That deer, if you have a neighbor that's not doing that, that's where that deer is going to go. So if I wanted to, if I hated deer and I hated mature bucks, I had a tree farm or something, and I didn't want them rubbing on my trees. If I went out there and messed with those bucks nonstop and harassed them and, you know, tried to kill them, they would get pushed to a farm that didn't happen on. So, so light hunting, busting them a couple times, I would say you're just going to change their pattern a little bit. You're going to change where they bed, and you're going to change how they travel. Mm-hmm. Pounding that deer over and over and over by multiple guys, you absolutely will push that deer off of that farm, gone. Maybe somebody gets a crack at him during the rut. Maybe somebody just gets lucky. But, I mean, your probability of getting that deer done correctly went from, you know, a shot at him went from 75% to 5% with the guys piss-pounding it, not doing it correctly. Because I know how it works. I know when you throw five guys into a mix or, you know, a large group, you know, a handful of them by definition are not hunting things when the wind's right. They're not accessing their stand when it's right. They're not, you know, their entrances and exits are poor. They're blowing deer. And they're just alerting everything. But that's the culture I had to grow up in. Mm-hmm. I mean, that by definition, every single farm I hunted, like I remember having 20 acres of timber and, you know, maybe 80 acres of open stuff, call it 100 acres. And there was 20 guys that had permission on that. And all that game was, is there anywhere on this farm where these guys aren't pounding it? And I could usually find a little spot over here. Yeah, these guys missed this spot. And that's where I shoot a deer. It wasn't like, let's find the best travel routes and the fresh sign and the funnels. And yeah. It wasn't that at all.
Yeah.
Now it is. Because I'm back to hunting natural deer. But back then, I mean, it wasn't natural at all. It's just, where aren't the people?
Yeah.
I got clearly extremely sick of that. But that's how I grew up. But, mm-hmm. you know, and understanding that, you know, it's just such a different dynamic to come to better states where it's not as piss-pounded as some other areas. And that's why when guys from Missouri or Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, when they come to Iowa and Kansas and maybe some parts of Illinois or some parts of Indiana, Kentucky, these guys that are like, listen, man, I've dealt with 20 guys on a little farm, stuff that gets piss pounded. These guys just, they flourish in the good Midwestern states. I mean, it's like you know, some of these guys from Michigan, Wisconsin, they're just so effective at hunting because they've had dealt with difficulty so long. It's like putting an NBA player against a bunch of elementary kids on a basketball court. I mean, it's a slaughter fest. But you know, with that, your mindset definitely has to change. Your tactics have to change when you get into these better areas. And that's where, you know, calling in October, if you would ask me in Michigan, hey, man, what are you thinking? Opening night of October, you're going to bring your grunt call? You're going to bring rattling antlers? No. No, you out of your mind? I just hope I see a deer.
Mm-hmm.
To now, yeah. October 1, I have a call and rattling antlers. And I have pretty high expectations when I do choose to go out. And I'm not going out every night. I just look at it and say, you know, it's going to be cold these 2 days. That's when I'm going out. Then it gets hot. I'm not going out.
Yeah.
I pick my days very, very carefully. And if you pick your days very carefully and the deer activity is good, I would say even your body language that you see and the responses to calls will be better too. So, you know, you go out and it's south wind and it's 85 degrees in October, you're not going to have a whole lot of action. I think that's fairly common sense.
Yeah.
But I would say pick your battles. Being unemployed, I can, you know, I can pick what nights I go out and hunt, which is a blessing. And then I can earn points with the wife, family, whatever. And, oh, no, I'm not going out for the rest of the week. I'm going to do whatever you want. Spend time with you, which I love. And, oh, you're not going to hunt? Well, it is 80 degrees out. Yeah. No, I'm going to hunt. I'm going to spend time with you. So, you know, it's just efficient. It's far more efficient. And I don't like going out when it's 80 degrees. No, thank you. I like it cool.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, that's why we love this stuff. There's all these different dynamics. There's all these moving pieces with hunting. And there's all these, you know, my mind, even 10 years ago, the things I did 10 years ago, I can look at a handful of them and go, that was just stupid. What I did was stupid. And guess what? 10 years from now, I'm going to look back at myself. I'm 45. When I'm 55, I'm going to look at my 45-year-old self and be like, you did this, 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 and this. That was stupid. Mistake. I'm always learning. And I love that part of it. I do love it.
All right. So let's go. When it comes to, you go off on so many tangents. I can't even link back into what I wanted to ask you about. Whatever, right? We'll get on another episode here in the next handful of weeks. I need to get you on some Adderall or something like that before we have our next episode to calm you down and get you focused.
I mean, I guess I'm, I understand.
Is what it is, right?
It's all good, man. I will call the doctor and say, listen, on this podcast, this guy thinks I need Adderall. I've seen commercials on TV. And the next podcast, I'm just going to be really
like lame, drool coming out of your mouth.
Really calm, no opinions, no passionate feelings on anything.
Touche.
Yeah. So,
well,
good chatting, good going all over the place. Hopefully folks can follow along and have a little bit of fun here too.
Yeah, absolutely. You're always a joy having on the podcast, and I appreciate you and I appreciate your time, and thank you for helping me load my buck in my truck this year. And I'm hoping that I can give you another call this upcoming year. I did text you a while back and I
on the hinge cutting.
Yeah, I got permission to do a little habitat work on specific trees on that farm. So I'm looking.
We'll get that done. I do remember that text, and that's why I said it before you said it. Hinge cutting, you got approved by the landowner. I love that. It's going to be great. Even just a little bit of work is going to make a huge benefit to that place that's, you know, wide open to, hey, man, there's structure in here now.
Yeah.
Just amazing benefits. Even if you spent 2-3 hours on this, it would be a huge move forward. So, we'll get rocking.
All right. Well, Skip, man, I really appreciate your time. Thanks again. And hey, there's still time to go turkey hunting.
No,
not gonna happen.
That's for you guys. You enjoy it.